Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What's up, everybody? How'd you get along with that Jen Sincero pod? She's pretty awesome. Did you write a letter to your money yet? You should try it for real. Now, if you haven't tuned in yet, I highly recommend it. Jen is a very cool lady, and if you listen to her, you might just see a few positive changes happening in your life. Okay, so on to today's episode. I recently got with my man Arthur Baker. It's another transatlantic connection with Arthur dialing in from his adopted home in Miami. If you don't know Arthur, he is a legendary music producer and a DJ who's been on the scene since he gave Muddy Waters a ride home when he was 17 years old. He's worked with literally everyone in the music business from Mary J. Blige to Miles Davis, and he's got all the stories you expect from a guy who's been around the block that fancy. So kick back and tune in for some more rock and roll insider stories on Huey Off the Record. I'm great, Arthur. Good to hear your voice, man.
Same here, man. How you doing?
I'm great, man. How's Miami, my brother?
It's, it's Miami in the, it's sort of tropical. It's been raining a lot, but last few days it's been nice and sunny, so I can't complain, you know? I mean, during the year, it was great. It was a great year. Like, the winter was amazing. The weather was great. Had some people come through. Yeah, so it was good. Yeah, the summer's usually shit. You know, I'm not really happy being here, but I'm renovating my house, so I have to sort of be around for sure.
Yeah, you got to keep an eye on them, man.
Oh man, they're so slow, and it's real. I wouldn't do it again if I had the opportunity. I would have just sucked it up and bought something, that I didn't like 100%. But you know, I think the way it went, it's a drag, but it'll be great when it's done, you know. But when it's that, you know, that's the word, when.
No, I hear you there. I mean, the operative word, man. I Becky did our house out in Somerset, where I'm talking to you from.
Yep.
Now. And you know, it's one of those old houses, bro, that, you know, you got to get permission to do everything here in England. So it's like,
oh. Well, the same here, though. You got to, everything's planning permits and
everything. Yeah.
It hasn't been fun.
Well, if you can see the light at the end of the tunnel and you're sure it's not a train, you might be something good happening, bro.
Yeah, we'll see. It's been a bad year. It's just been, you know, it's been great because of the kid, of course.
Yeah.
But you know, otherwise it's been sort of slow. The first half of the year has been slow, so.
Yeah, so you're a new dad. You know, I have a young daughter now who's almost two. She'll be two the end of September.
Yeah, mine's three. Was just three in July.
Yeah,
So yeah.
Amazing times, right? Amazing.
Yeah,
times.
Yeah. No, she's amazing. She's such a punk, man. She doesn't. I'm really screwed because she doesn't listen now, and she's only three. So I know it's not going to get better. It's going to get worse. You know?
Well, I have the same thing with my boy. So when he was about two, we started realizing that he wasn't like all the other kids. You know, he wasn't just like, yes, daddy, yes, mommy. He was like, yo, what, what?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm getting now. I mean,
well, you wouldn't have it any other way, though, dude.
Well, I don't know about that. No, it's great. So I can't. I'm definitely not complaining. It's just that, you know. Being an older dad and having, you know, having a daughter who absolutely doesn't listen. You know, it's just, she thinks it's funny though. That's the thing. She actually thinks it's funny, which is cool. You know, it's cool that she thinks it's funny that she doesn't listen to me.
Well, yeah, that's, they got to find something funny. At least they can laugh at their own stuff. But I think,
oh, she can laugh. She's a super character.
Well, that's what we get. That's what we get. But also, being an older dad, we can appreciate that. I know I do. I'm like, wow. If I was younger, I would totally not get the irony here. You know.
Yeah. So what are you up to?
Well, I mean, I'm doing a bunch of stuff right now. I'm in the studio with the Criminals. We're getting some stuff together. Yeah, cool. It'll be the first time in a while. So we're covering. We did a record years ago called Mimosa.
And yeah, I know, of course.
So it was like a bunch of covers, a couple reworkings of originals, some new songs. So we're doing that as like kind of like a template. We've got some cool covers. We got like a Neil Diamond cover and an Ice Cube cover. So, and everything
in between. Cool.
Yeah, so we're working it, man. We're having fun getting down.
Right.
Actually, you know what? We should actually talk about the first time we worked together, which was, where was it? L.A., right?
Was it L.A.? I don't remember. It must have been L.A., right?
Yeah, it was perfect.
It was 1999, because it was right before the millennium, right?
It was perfect day, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't. It's only rock and roll.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Damn, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. God, at least I remember shit. You remember where it was.
I remember where it was because it was A&M, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was fun. We got really hammered. Yeah, well, we could talk about that for sure.
Yeah, man. So when I got, that was like the first time I actually went out to a proper recording studio in L.A. I was fucking stoked, Arthur, man.
Really? Yeah, that was a great studio too. A&M, that has a lot of history. I had a lot of history to it for sure.
I knew it from We Are the World, right? That was the one.
Yeah, that's true. I forgot. Yeah, they cut We Are the World there, and they cut a lot of the A&M rock acts. Soundgarden probably recorded. You know, a lot of the rock acts on A&M recorded there, and I never worked there. That was the only time I ever worked there. You know, I had gone to visit friends there, but I never worked there. I worked on a few of the other spots, Sunset, Sunset, one of the places. But yeah, I didn't do a lot of work in L.A. I mean, the big gig I had in L.A. is when I did the From Green Tomatoes soundtrack album, which we pretty much cut it all in L.A. So that was my big L.A. trip.
Yeah, I'm trying to get back out there. The idea now is like, if we can travel for business, I take the family with me, man. You know, so to go out to LA for a couple of weeks to mix a record would be great.
Yeah, that would be cool.
I loved A&M because it had like the gate. It was like going on a lot. You know what I mean? Mac, yeah, LA style.
A&M was it was fun. That project was really fun. It was sort of one of those projects that sort of happened really weirdly, and then it happened, it was gone. But when I look back and all the people are on the record and how we recorded, because it was literally right before technology caught up with everything. So, yeah. You know, we were using new technology because we were able to go and record people in their hotel rooms and you know, at backstage at gigs. But it almost was there, but it wasn't there 100%. So, you know, it wasn't as smooth as it would be now, but it was still so different that you could do that. And you know, we recorded like Mary J. Blige in her hotel room in Paris and Jamiroquai and backstage at his gig, you know. So it was like, yeah. we were just, I mean, it was a pretty cool project, actually. Looking back, it was, you know, it sort of worked out pretty well, actually. But no one remembers the record.
I mean, did it come out as it came out as a
Well, it came out as the Children's Trust. It was BBC Children's Trust. I think it went, you know, it was a top 10 record. Made the pop chart, but they had thought it would be a number one. And there, I forget what else came out, but there were a bunch of other things. But it was a really interesting group of people on the record. I mean, we had some really, really horrible pop acts, and then some really cool, you know, cool rock acts, and you know. I mean, think about who's on that record, man. You know, Ozzy Osbourne and Iggy are both on that record. pretty bizarre. And with the Spice Girls, you know.
And Mary J.
And S Club 7. I think Probably the diversity of that record was probably the when you think about it, it was the most diverse sort of charity record of all time, I think, you know.
Yeah, I'd say I remember when I got approached by it, the reason I did it was like Arthur Baker. I was like, hell yeah, Arthur Baker, that's my man. I love that dude. And I'll tell you, you know, when I look back on my musical education, like I think I probably told you, like Planet Rock, I remember hearing that and going, I've never heard anything like this before.
Yeah, when I did it, I thought that too.
But is it? I mean, that's like, yeah. that's like someone like, you're like in the category of people like Miles Davis for that kind of thing. You know, as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you.
No, it's like you hear like Muddy Waters, you hear blues music, yeah. Electric blues, stuff like that.
You know, I love Muddy Waters. I met Muddy Waters and I met Miles Davis and I worked with Miles, but I never worked with Muddy, but I actually hung out with Muddy Waters. So,
tell me that story again, because that story is fucking amazing, Arthur.
What, the Muddy one?
The Muddy Waters story, in your house drinking whiskey.
I had Muddy. Basically, I went to a gig. He played at this club in Boston called Paul's Mall, and I worked at a record shop that sold tickets for Paul's Mall, so I had free tickets to anything I ever wanted to go see. And I mean, the gigs there, I saw Bob Marley play there. I saw Little Feat play there. You know, you would see Horace Silver and Chick Corea and just everybody. But I went to see Muddy Waters, and I don't know why. Maybe it was me, but none of my friends came with me. So I actually went on my own, and I just got a driver's license. So I was 17, and I had a car. And basically, I went to the Muddy Waters gig, and after the gig, as you used to be able to do back then, you go back, you talk yourself backstage, mm-hmm. get backstage, and chill with Muddy, you know. And we're talking and shit, and basically, all of a sudden, he looks around, and it's just me and Muddy hanging out, and then he realizes that no one's there, and he doesn't even know how to get to where he's, you know, where he's staying, which isn't a hotel, which is at the promoter's house, which was in Newton, which is, you know, suburban town, but it was the town right next to where I lived, mm-hmm. lived at the time, obviously. So I said, well, you know, I'll give you a ride, you know, no fucking problem. So I'm driving Muddy Waters. It's insane, because I'm like 17. He was probably 60 at the time, maybe more, I don't know. And literally, it must have been in like 72, I would guess, 72. So basically, I said, oh, you don't mind if we stop at my house, because I just bought Fathers and Sons, which was an album that he was out actually promoting.
Yeah.
So I got the record and I said, oh, you want to come in? So he came in for a second. My parents were upstairs sleeping, and he came in, signed the record. Then we went, you know, we went on to where we were going, which was where he was staying, which I didn't even know how I would have found it out, because obviously there was no Google Maps or anything. I don't know how I would have got there. You know, yeah. Think about trying to find stuff back in the day. I mean, right? How do we find anything? You know, especially when you were drunk or stoned, you would have had to know where it was. So I think it was sort of in a neighborhood where I knew, and it was close to like a coffee shop, whatever. I got him back, and Mojo Buford God, who else was – there are a few guys from the group, but Mojo Buford was one of the guys. So, you know, they're just, you know, they're drinking Johnny Walker and just hanging out. So I literally hung out with Muddy Waters drinking whiskey and, you know, when I was 17. And you know, I have the signed record. Unfortunately, no selfies, you know, but what can you do? But
you know, yeah.
It was a great night, man. It was, you know – back then, I had a few of those as a young kid getting close to genius like that, you know. Like one time we went to a Celtics game, and I was a big Celtics fan, and we were waiting after the game for autographs, and Earl Monroe came out, and it was his rookie year. It was the Bullets, Washington Bullets, and you know we get his autograph and everything, and we're talking to him. I'm there with my dad and my sister. And then again, he like looks around, and then no one from the team was there. Literally, everyone had left, and he was there on his own. And it was his first
Earl.
It was his first trip to Boston, and you know, you don't really want to be lost in Boston as a black man, especially back then.
Yeah.
So literally, especially, you know, whatever. So we said, oh, you know, you want a ride? We'll give you a ride. So my dad, you know, he got in the front seat and me and my sister in the back seat. And we again, he was staying out, not in Boston, like, you know, not in the midst of Boston. It was more like a suburban hotel, which we eventually found because we did get lost. So it was sort of embarrassing. And then years later, because when he was living in, when I first moved to New York, at, say around 82, 83, he had a label called Pretty Pearl Records. And he had Happy Hairston's brother, Curtis Hairston, had a record on his label, which was sort of a hit around the time that I was having hits there too. So, you know, he lived in my neighborhood. He was living on the Upper West Side. So one time I just said, hey man, you know, I'm in the music. And we started talking. I said, I know you'll never remember this, but we gave you a ride, you know, blah, blah, blah. He said, oh yeah. And then I said, really? He said, nah, I don't remember.
That'd be too much, right?
which was funny. So that was cool. So, you know, that kind of stuff happened. I mean, when I was in Boston and working in the record shop, I did get opportunities that you would not have gotten if you weren't working in a record shop. I mean, I met James Brown. That one I have a picture of, so that's cool. I was like 19. I have a picture of me and James Brown. So, you know, that kind of stuff did happen. I was really pushy, and I started writing articles at the Bay Street Banner, which was a black newspaper, and I wrote record reviews. So literally I'd get free tickets through that and I'd be able to get backstage and do interviews. So that was, yeah, I was probably like 20 then. So
that's dope, man. I mean, meeting James Brown, I met James Brown. And the thing I always took away from James Brown is that he spoke a lot more softly than I thought he would. You know what I mean?
Yeah. He wasn't going, yo,
man. I don't know why I thought he was going to be shouty. Yeah. No, but he was like, you know, he came up to me. We did a gig together in Belgium and he came up with his girl at the time. He was like, hey, man, that was really, really, really special, man. I was like, pardon? You know, I couldn't really hear him. I was like, what'd you say, man? But, yeah, he was a really nice guy, man.
Yeah, yeah. I met him a couple more times in my career. Like, well, he was on the record, too. He was on It's Only Rock and Roll also. Yeah. But literally, I wasn't there for that session because I was on vacation and Al Green had already stood me up on one, and I was like, you know, I know James Brown ain't gonna show up to this, so I'm not coming back for this session. And then of course, so that was a bit of that was definitely a drag for me because, you know, I never did work with him, so it would have been cool. I mean, I did meet him a couple of times, and I met him when he was sitting under a hair dryer, one of those old school women's hair dryers. He was having his hair rolled up and curled and shit. So I had a meeting with him while he was doing that. So that was clearly weird, but, you know.
That's James Brown for you. Yo, tell me the story about Miles Davis. How'd you end up working with him?
Well, I worked with Miles actually twice, which I did get to hang with him a little bit. The first time was Sun City. He played on Sun City.
Yeah. And if anybody doesn't know Sun City, that's little Stevie Van Zandt and Arthur did this record about this place in South Africa, right? That you
don't like. Yeah, it was like an anti-apartheid.
Yeah.
What Sun City was, it was sort of like the Las Vegas of South Africa, but they made it in a separate homeland called Batu Botswana. And basically, so they said it wasn't South Africa. So artists could actually come and play, which was a lie. And a lot of artists actually did go and play. And Steven went down there to do some research. And then when he came back, he was like, you know, we got to do a record. You know, we got to do a record. And, you know, Steven and I just met and we were like, yeah, let's do it. I'm down. And we did this record called Ain't Gonna Play Sun City.
I love that
show. You know, originally we were like, Steven was like, yeah, we'll get four rockers and we'll get four rappers. And I'm like, man, come on, you're thinking too little. We're going to get everybody. You know, so basically we started using all our contacts and we ended up having unbelievable artists on the record, one of which was supposedly going to be Miles Davis. So somehow we got to Miles and he kept, you know, we'd get, oh, Miles is coming tonight. And then he wouldn't show up, or he's coming in the morning and he doesn't show up. And then just one day, we're in the studio and we're working with, it was Bonnie Raitt and Kashif were both in there recording vocals on it. And literally, you know, in my studio, Shakedown Sound back then, you know, there was a buzzer down. We were on the second floor, and there was a buzzer in the front door. And, you know, it would ring up in the studio, and, you know, usually there'd be people just screwing around with us and buzzing the thing and all that. But, you know, we weren't really expecting anyone. We get a buzz, and it's like, hey, it's Miles, let me up.
He's let me like in. That,
we're like, oh, shit, you know. So me and Steven were both there, luckily, and we're like, oh, my God, he's actually coming up. And we go back, and we tell Bonnie's singing, and Kashif is about to, and we go to Bonnie, well, Miles is coming up. So Miles comes in, he, there's pictures of this. He's dressed in it. He has like a polka dot, like, shawl, like silk. It was just, he was dressed ridiculous. It was like super fly. Like, this was 85, but he was dressed like it was almost like the 70s, but, you know, big glass sunglasses. You know, he was super hip,
Yeah.
So we actually go back and, you know, we bring him back and, you know, Bonnie sees him and she obviously immediately just sort of comes out of the control room and goes, oh, you know, Mr. Davis, you know, I just love what you do, you know, when you're on, you're just amazing. Yeah, baby, just my thing, you know, like that. And he's just so hardcore. And we put him out there and literally we had cameras there because we were filming everything. And there was this guy, Danny Schechter, who had been like a newsman from Boston. He had been my mentor when I was a kid because he was on BCN. Uh-huh. And he was like during the Vietnam War, he was like the journalist on air. They call him Danny Schechter, the news dissector. And he was like super hip.
I love that.
And then when he moved
man.
To New York, when he moved to New York, he ended up being on 2020 on ABC. So he had a lot of juice and he was able to get like film crews there. Like he'd get them on the slide. So we had a film crew there and Miles was there and the cameraman's in the control room with him. And we start playing the track and it's like, he's like going, you can't come in here. You're the wrong color. And we're like, oh shit, is he talking about the cameraman? And we just let it roll. And obviously he's sort of the voice of South Africa telling, you know, you can't come in here. You're the wrong color. So he did this really cool vocal thing on the beginning of the song, which is on the record. And then he just played all the way through and it was just, you know, genius. It was amazing. And, you know, when Doug Winbush, who I think, you know, bass player, played with everybody, he had like just said, he played on the record. He just said, if Miles shows up, you've got to call me right away. So we had called him. And he runs over, and he's, like, out of breath. And Miles is about to leave, and he comes in.
He played in Living Color, goes, right?
He goes, Mr. Davis, you know, I've waited to meet you my entire life. And Miles goes, well, I guess today's your lucky day. It just totally, you know, like, Doug's a pretty cool guy, but he totally blew Doug's cool on that. It just, Doug fell back like he had been shot. It was just a very funny moment. But, yeah, so I worked with him on that, and then when I did the Listen Up, The Lives of Quincy Jones, which was the Quincy Jones documentary, we did a, Miles had been in the film being interviewed, and then when we did the premiere at the Apollo, we had to do a show, and literally it was me and Arif, because Arif had worked on the soundtrack with me and written a song, we had written a song together. So literally there was a rehearsal and there were, I mean, the people who played George Duke and Wayne Shorter and all these guys like Chaka and James Ingram and all these people were going to play. And literally, you know, it was sort of my job to, you know, do the running schedule. So I had said to Miles, I said, listen, you know, we have this big choir. So I wanted the choir to open it up. And be in front of the stage, and then they were gonna like split in two, you know, like move to each side, and then Miles would be behind them. And I thought, oh, this could be really dramatic opening, and you know, the choir, and then they part, and there's Miles, and blah blah. He goes, man, I just want to play a fucking song and get the fuck out of there. So I want to go in first. So he's like, he won't even listen to me. You know, he's not gonna listen. So literally, he's like my daughter. You know, he's not gonna listen to me. So he's not gonna listen. And literally, So he's on first, but of course, being Miles, he wouldn't get off the stage. So he starts playing, and he won't leave the stage. It's like he plays like 30 minutes. It was supposed to be like 10. And then in the midst of his set, Flavor Flav jumps on stage to try to go give him a hug. Miles literally turns his back on Flavor Flav. Two security guards get each of Flavor Flav's elbows and just lift him off the stage. So that was a crazy night. And literally, there's like no film of it at all. It's insane. No one filmed it. There's nothing of that night. And that was like 92.
Was that the tunnel?
People were starting to think about filming. I mean, and it was a documentary, so we have thousands of hours of stuff, but no one thought to film the gig, you know?
Wow.
So, yeah. So those are a few of my many old OG stories, you know?
Dude, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who's an English dude, and I was talking to him today. I was like, yeah, I'm going to be talking to Arthur on the podcast. He goes, yo, man, you got to ask him about the Hacienda. And I go, I know that he probably been in the Hacienda, but it's apartments now. And I think he was talking about New Order.
Yeah, no, I've been to the Hacienda. Yeah, I was there when I DJed there a couple of times towards the end.
Yeah, that's what I thought, man. Because you spin some dope records, man, when you go out, man. Did you keep all the
records? Yeah, well, when I DJed at the Hacienda, man, that was actually when I was really starting to get back into DJing. I hadn't DJed in years, so it was a weird set, which I literally think I have a dad of it somewhere.
That's dope.
You know, I played a lot of funk, I played a lot of Parliament, I played a lot, you know, I pretty much played a funk set. I didn't play a house, and I didn't play in the main room, I played in the basement, but it was sort of cool, you know, it was fun. I mean, I probably went to the Hacienda maybe five or six times, so I did get a chance. I started coming to London in 87 or 88, so I definitely made it up to the Hacienda in you know, the late 80s, early 90s. So, you know, I was definitely there in the heyday of the Hacienda. And, you know, I mean, back in the day, I started coming to London, it was definitely 87, 88, and that's when clubs like Shoom and Heaven and all the whole sort of Balearic vibe with Ibiza, that all started around then. So it was a good time to be in London. I mean, I remember going to a rave with Martin and Martin Fry from ABC, you know. So
Literally
I was sort of here for that whole era, which I mean, I was in London for that whole era, which was great, you know. I mean, literally from 92 really to 2012, 13, I pretty much lived in London. So, you know, I mean, this is the longest I haven't been in London in 25 years. I mean, I haven't been there since September. So, I mean, I'm coming in for a few weeks, but this year it just didn't work out that I'd be there. And hopefully next summer, if everything goes right, I'll be able to spend the summer there, you know, because I still love being in London for sure, you know.
Yeah, the summer's kicking in, man. I was driving around the West Country today, man. It's beautiful, beautiful style.
I mean, last summer was a great summer. I mean, I spent like a month in London, and we sold our flat in Notting Hill, and we got a place in Kensal Rise. So I was sort of experiencing a new area, but there were a lot of nice parks there, and we were going to Queen's Park a lot. Yeah. So, yeah.
It's a nice area. Yeah, I was up that area when I used to live in London, man.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm still miss it, actually. I mean, it'll be cool to get back in July for a few weeks. I mean, I'm going to be there. I'm going to put out a record around that time. So I'm going to go back and try to, like, hustle some press and get some airplay, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if I can help you on that, man.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I did want to ask you about how'd you get hooked up with the dudes in New Order? How, like, is that, like, I don't think I ever asked you, man.
Yeah, they approached me, really. My friend, who's unfortunately passed away a few years, Michael Schamberg, he ran Factory Records New York, and basically, it was after Joy Division. It's right when New Order had started, and he approached me. It was probably 81, 82, and he approached me and said, New Order, you want to do a couple of tracks with them, they're going to be coming into town. And I was like, yeah, sure. I really hadn't heard their music. And then I went back and did some research and heard Love Will Tear Us Apart and stuff. So I did some research, and they sent me stuff, and this is like crazy, because they sent me a bunch of demos, which I never even listened to. Because, at the time I was just about, listen, when a group comes in, let's write together, let's come up with something together, as opposed to producing something that someone else already started and you have to match the demo and all that. So I was really all about let's write in the studio, let's write in the writing room, which is what we did. We went out to Brooklyn and we wrote a couple of tracks and I finished one, Confusion, and then they finished the other, which became Thieves Like Us. So, yeah, I mean, we've been friends. I mean, we're still really tight, and, Hookie was at my wedding, and Barney, I'm really tight with Barney and Hookie, and obviously it's a drag that they're at war with each other, but, that's life,
Yeah, I mean, we hope they'll see the end of that pretty soon. Dude, I wanted to ask you about Miami, man. Like, you've been down there vibing on the music. Can you give me, like, a little kind of, like, I guess a Bleacher report from what's going on in Miami?
Yeah, Miami, it's funny because I was always successful. My tracks were really successful in Miami, like, more than anywhere else. The electro stuff,
yeah.
All the soul sonic, and all the freestyle, and even songs like IOU, Play at Your Own Risk, all that stuff was really, really big in Miami, and literally big for a long time. So basically, I bought an apartment here in like 91 or something, the first time I bought a place here. And literally, I'd come down and I'd get, I'd get in a cab off of the plane, and I'd hear like Play at Your Own Risk, or I'd hear IOU or Planet Rock. And literally, those songs were like 10 years old. And
yeah, welcome home, Arthur, right?
What?
I mean, all those songs you hear all the time anyway, man.
Yeah, but it was weird because this was 10 years later, and it was sort of like on the regular radio. It was on pop radio. So they were still in rotation 10 years after the fact, and people were really into them. So it was a really weird place. I mean, basically, it really, like nowhere else. So a lot of people I meet here, in New York, whatever, people like appreciate the songs and, they might know who I am or what. But here, most of the people I meet that I'm hanging with grew up on that shit. And literally they're not, say they're in their early 40s, around that age. So, they're like, early 40s. So that, we're talking like 25 years ago, they were like 15, 14, 16, they were kids, and they were into the track. So it's sort of funny because these are people I hang with now, and they're like, dude, you don't understand, and also with Breakers, with Beat Street, so also yeah. With that. So that was really influential down here too. So it's really weird. So a lot of the guys I hang with now actually came up on my music, and they're still making music and they're still doing cool things. I mean, there's a lot going on in Miami as far as clubs. There's a lot more clubs in Miami than there are in London or in New York. There's a ton of clubs here. There's great places. And there's a lot of, there's a lot of DJs who are either from here or based out of here from, the Merc guys, they're really good friends of mine. We're making some new music together. And they, they are sort of the sound of Miami. They've been doing music since like late 80s, and when they were really young kids. So now, they're mid 40s now, and they're still, still doing stuff. I mean, they have a weekly at this place called Coyo Tacos, which I hooked them up with, and it's like it's a back room in a taco place, and they've got the best sound. And
Wait, so that spot's been going for a minute, that taco spot.
Yeah, it's like 4 or 3 years or something. But basically, I hooked them up, so they do a Monday. Every Monday, it's like they always wanted to have a weekly, like they were saying, like how Louis used to have Sound Factory Bar.
Yeah.
So they're like, that's what they do. And it's literally, and you know, whenever I want to DJ, like next Monday, I want to go play some tracks and you know, that I'm working on. It's really cool because, you know, when you play there, you definitely play a little bit more Latin than you would, because Oscar's whole thing is a lot of Latin percussion. It's like techno mixed with Latin. So that's what Merck has always been.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was pulling out shit out of my old tracks, and it was funny because I found this track that I made in like 95 or something. And, you know, I played it out and people really got into it, and Oscar wasn't there. So I sent him the track, and I sent him like four tracks. I didn't want to just send him the one, because so I said, here's four tracks I got, you know, if you're interested in any of them. And he, like 20 minutes later, he got back to me and said, yo, bro, what the fuck is it? What is that track? And I go, yeah, something I, you know, I got it. He said, well, look, you know, I want to put it out on the label. And I go, oh, well, you got it. He said, well, when did you make that? I said, I made it like 20 years ago. And he couldn't believe it, because the shit sounded so current. So it was sort of like trying to find stuff that I did that never came out. And then I made a track called Koyo that I actually made for the club. And I did the vocals myself in my living room using a phone, you know, the iPhone and all that.
Yeah, man.
And I sent that to him, and he said, dude, you know, that's slamming. Let us mix that. So they're going to mix that. So I'm doing a couple of tracks with him. And then there's Danny Days. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he's another electro kid.
Danny Days, is he Kenny Dope's boy? Because I was down there with Kenny Dope one time, and he was like, yo.
Yeah, man. Yeah, Kenny would know him, yeah, for sure. He's from Miami. He's living in Berlin a lot now. He plays all Berkheim and all those clubs, but he's a really cool guy. And then Maceo Plex is from here, was here. He's not here around here much. This cat Beirus has a club here. He plays a lot in Ibiza. He has a club called Don't Sit on the Furniture. And then there's a club called Electric Pickle. The guys from Soul Clap like have a residency there. There's a club called Trade, which is amazing. There's Live, there's Story, there's Heart, there's Space. I mean, literally, there's about 10 rocking clubs. Like, you know, one of those clubs, you're gonna find, you know, international DJs or local DJs, but they're rocking. So I mean, it's a lot. To me, it's a lot more happening than London. I mean, maybe London's getting a little bit better again, but in Miami, there's like four or five clubs that are small clubs, like 200-300, really cool vibe. Then there's like ones, a couple that are like 1,000. And then you got a couple that are like 2, and then Liv is like probably 2,500. But then there's a place called 11, which is open all night, and it's a strip club, but they also have DJs and Diplo plays there and stuff. So, yeah, I mean Miami, the club scene is really strong. I mean, literally, you can go out and then there's the Fillmore, and that's where all the gigs are. You know, this year I saw Iggy played there and New Order and the Pet Shop Boys. So they all that's where they play.
That's
so
the spot.
Literally, you get a lot of groups coming through there. It's a great music town for sure. You know, you get everyone comes through here. Yeah.
So Iggy lives down there now. He's been living down there for like...
He's been living there for like 20 years.
Yeah, like since that's the late 90s.
That's why he's alive, you know? I mean, you know, Bowie and Lou Reed lived in New York, man. Look at how that did him. I mean, literally, Miami, I'm sure Miami has a lot to do with Iggy's, you know, health and everything, because he's in really good shape. And, you know, he's like, you know, it's funny because he played on this tour that he was with the guys from System and all that, and he did a gig here, and he had a cold, and he was like trying to talk, and he was like, "What the fuck was I thinking, man? Going up north, you know? It's my fault. I should have just stayed home in the winter. You don't go up north. What was I thinking? So it was very funny. But
when he comes out to England, because he does radio out here in the UK, man.
Yeah, I don't know if he. I don't know how much he does there and how much he takes.
Once in a while, he comes through. He's going to be coming through on festivals. I'm going to be hanging with him.
Yeah, he'll be there for festivals for sure. And Irvin Welsh lives down here now too. And that's my buddy, man. Me and him are very tight. So, he lives here. He's living here half the time now too.
All right. Well, I mean, you can see why, man. I mean, every time I go down to Miami, I'm always like, why don't I live here?
I know. Seriously, it's literally, even if you just do it 6 months out of the year, it's just, or 4 months or whatever. I mean, for us, we made the decision that we wanted, to have our baby grow up in warm weather and not like damp and not, she's somewhat sensitive and, with colds and stuff. And I was just like, you know what? It's like, well, why not? And I mean, I love it here. So it's sort of.
Like, I look at things like this, man. I mean, if you're near an airport, you could be anywhere in the world in like under a day.
Yeah,
so.
That's why I haven't been. I haven't been in Europe all year. I mean, it's the first time. I mean, since September. But, I'm planning on being there more coming up. But, this year it's been pretty, not a lot of reason to travel,
No, you got a young kid, man. It's always good to be able to kind of post up somewhere for a minute. I know I did that. That's, oops, sorry.
Yeah. The UK, that Duval from the Disciples is singing on, and there's an old sample of one of my old tracks, a Will Downing vocal. And I think the song's called, Just Can't Stop Dancing, and it's pretty strong. So I'm going to be out there trying to get it kicking off. It's definitely not easy these days. But
how do you see the landscape with, like, because I mean, aside from being a producer and an artist, man, you also, I mean, you and I used to talk a lot about, the hustle that used to be in the record business that's kind of almost not there anymore because no one really knows what to hustle.
Yeah, I mean, back in the day, you could put out a record on an independent label and sell 50,000 and 100,000 or 20,000, and it wasn't necessarily a huge hit, but there was a market for what we were doing. And the first Tommy Boy record that made any money was Jazzy Sensation, and that sold like 50,000, and it got Mr. Magic were playing it. But you could be in New York, get radio play, Mr. Magic, a few spins on him, and just the vibe in the city, you could sell 50,000 records, And that's actually what kept Tommy Boy, that one kept Tommy Boy in business, before we did Planet Rock. So it used to be way different, and now there's so many more records, like it's insane because anyone could make a record, anyone could put out a record or put it online, no one really cares about selling them, so it's more like self-promotion. But you sort of want to sell something, So, I mean, you sell merchandising and stuff, but, if I put out a record as a new act, unless it really takes off, no one's going to want to buy the merchandise. So, literally that's where the groups that have the heritage, like you guys, you can sell your merch and people, you'll have fans who are going to go, oh yeah, that's cool. I'll buy that, because it's like a brand, when you have a brand, you can sell and make money on that. Whereas, if you're starting a new brand, it really, unless it's super successful or it's super cool and clever, which I guess you got to sort of do that too. So, it's hard work now. That's for sure. It's hard work.
Now you listen, like when you said earlier, man, like if you're an independent record label and you sell 50,000 records, that's like good money. Right. And that's
back then, if you sell 50,000 now, you got a number one record in England.
Exactly.
Right. I mean, you're like doing well if you can sell 50,000.
I remember I'm looking at a plaque now for Loco, and it's like over 300,000 copies.
Dude, you would have been, if you sold that now, man, you forget it. you'd be running, you know, the UK, you know.
Well, it makes me realize, like, I remember when I got that plaque, I made a lot of loot from that record, man. I was like, yeah. You know, I was like, this is what I'm talking about.
And, yeah, for sure, man.
I'm wondering, I'm wondering about, like, the kids nowadays. Like, I'm saying kids, I'm not worried about Drake's money, but, you know, he's not making it on record sales anymore. So, essentially, he's, like, a live artist, and he's, like, a T-shirt salesman, kind of.
Yeah, but, you know,
there's nothing wrong with that. Look, I'm all about the hustle and stuff, but it puts your priorities must shift to a certain extent. Of, like, you used to be the guy that, you know, you're making music to sell shows out, right? That's what I always thought we did. But
yeah.
And then you get to be a musician that you're making records to sell records. And then when you're not even selling records anymore.
You know, I want to make music, right? So basically, I like making music. And what do you do with the music? You put it out so that maybe you'll get, I mean, for me, it's either you put it out so someone's going to hear it and want you to remix a song. Uh-huh. Or you put it out. And it sells, or no, it doesn't sell, but it gets an attention and you get some DJ gigs.
Yeah.
So literally now music really is just, it's a promotional device for other potential business. I mean, that's the reality, you know. For you guys, it'll be to get people to come and see your shows or buy your T-shirts or whatever. Because the record thing is you're not, you know, I mean, chances of actually selling a lot of records enough that makes it worth thinking about doing it to sell records is not, it's not that easy, you know, it's not really happening. I mean,
well,
you
know,
it happens to very few people. I mean, it happens to some, but of course, you know, you can't be tripping, you know?
Yeah, you can't be tripping. I did notice, like, when the chart started shifting in the UK, because it's not a sales chart anymore. It's more, they have streaming, and that counts, I think it's like 10 streams counts as a buy or something like that. But it is like, you know, one of those things where, you know, you have to really like making music to make music nowadays. So I almost think that might thin the herd out, because there was that point where everybody was getting famous for a minute and, like, you know, everybody had a record deal. I mean, I remember hearing people who had record deals going, I didn't even understand what kind of music they were making. And then that all stopped and everybody was doing it on their own. And I think that's kind of, it's kind of proliferated it a little bit, but at the same time, it's made it, you know, you're getting better music on a certain level. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I hear music I like, you know, but the bottom line is, do I buy it? Not really. I do occasionally, you know, if it's something I really want to DJ out, then I really want it to sound right, then you buy it, you know?
Yeah. That's the thing. I mean, I might be old school, but I'll go to iTunes or something like that if I want to get a copy of something. I'd rather pay for it than to rip it off. But there was a point in my life when I wasn't always so generous.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm not that. I'll do it with tracks that I really want, you know, have a quality copy because I want to play it out and it's going to sound good.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I guess, you know, that's the test of how good a song is if a DJ wants to buy it for his own collection.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. But, you know, the other thing is now what I'm trying to do is when I DJ, I'm just trying to play my own stuff. And I'm trying to promote, I'm trying to promote it in that way and make it so that, basically I've been talking to, like, a couple of agents because I don't have an agent and we've been kicking around concepts. And one of those is sort of really specifically to promote it as that. But, it's like, unless it's promoted that way, then when you do that and you're playing, like, a lot of your old stuff and people don't know what it is, they're just going to think you're a whack DJ, you know? You know what I mean? Because if they don't realize, well, he's playing stuff that he's made over the last 30 years, you know, it's sort of like if you know that, then you might have an open ear and be appreciative of it. If you don't know that, you're just going to go, what is that? What is he playing? You know, doesn't he have any new records?
Well, lucky for you, all the stuff that you did is dope. So, I mean, there are a lot of people that can't do that.
Thank you. But the bottom line is, it's like the kids, it's funny because I probably never told you the story, but the Martinez brothers had seen a thing. I had done like an electro set at the Scala in London, and it was on the internet, and they had seen it, and they were like, yo, bro, we're going to do this party in Ibiza. It's a villa thing, and it's going to be hip and blah, blah, blah. We want you to play that set, you know, we're going to, and I go, oh, okay, cool, man. I'll do it. You know, you'll see what happens, but you know, I'll do the set. So I went there.
What does that mean?
I went there, and I was like, you know, if they had introed it, like if they had been playing, and then they play an electro track, and then I come in right after them and play a few electro tracks, that would make sense. But they just put me in this area, and they said, "Yo, play your set." And then literally, you know, I'm playing it, and people are looking at me like, "Doesn't this guy have any new records?" Like, for sure, you know. For sure, because it was all young kids and it was all hipster, you know, that I beat the crowd. So, you know, I was like, damn, you know. So then I just started playing some, you know, like house records. You know, sort of like they wanted me to play early 80, 81 to 85, my shit. So then I started playing like late 80s, early 90s house, which is literally, it relates more to what's going on now in Ibiza for sure. Like the electro thing. Has never really, the electro that we talk about is electro, has never really taken off in Ibiza because it's not straight kick music. It's, you know, funky kicks. So literally, so I started doing that and it was rocking. And then, you know, then I just said to him, you know, listen, this is a reality. You know, people hear these house tracks out more than they hear the electro tracks because they're easier to play. You know, anyone can play old 80, you know, 87, 88, 89 house music. It's easy to DJ that stuff because, you know, they're all the same, around the same tempo, you know.
Yeah, straight kick drums, lots of floor, four on the floor,
Yeah, so it makes it easier. So it's sort of like you have to sort of educate the people and you have to really be clever on how you do it. And, you know, I'm making a lot of new music that I think is in the ballpark. So it's sort of, you know, bottom line is sort of picking the ones that actually are more than being in the ballpark, that they're actually really good. And that's, you know, it's definitely not easy, you know, because literally it was easier like 5 years ago. I was getting a lot of gigs and now it's sort of, you know, there's so much techno and so much underground and it just sort of, you know, no one really plays everything. You know, it's very ghettoized now more than it used to be. So either you're playing this or you're playing that. If you try to mix it up, unless you're there are a few people who mix it up. And there are a few people who mix it up but don't mix it up as much as they did 5 years ago. You know, you used to go to DC10 in Ibiza and hear a lot of vocals. And now you don't hear any vocals. It's just underground, you know, it's, you know, I guess it's the new drugs people are doing. So it's a different
synthetics, you know? Man. Synthetics.
Yeah. So it's just like, you know, who the fuck knows? But, you know, I still make cool, you know, every so often I make a really cool record. So, you know, it's just hoping one of those cool records actually gets enough play to make a difference. Because, you know, I had one record out earlier this year that I did with Steve Mack. And it was a cool record. And Pete Tong played it a couple of times. And a lot of guys were saying, oh, yeah, I'm playing that out. But, you know, you need, like, a lot of people to play it out a bit. To really make any dent because it's so much music out there and you know it's like you hear very few records like one record across a bunch of clubs it doesn't really happen that often.
Well, you're right about the ghettoization of it too, because if you have like, say you're looking at like that kind of old school house vibe, right? That's not going to happen in too many places.
No There's people who play it, but they're not like playing at the cool clubs, you know. It's sort of like, or the clubs that we think of as being cool or whatever. I mean, you know, where all the hot chicks hang out, I guess.
Those are all the cool clubs. Like, yeah.
You know, I have a new track coming out called "Raise Your Hands," and it's got vocal samples from Tata Vega and Daryl Pandy and stuff that I recorded like 25 years ago. And Victor Simonelli did a remix of it, and it's a real like old school house thing. And he plays it at his clubs, and he's like, "Yo, this is like a peak. People are going nuts." And then you know he shows me the people who are going nuts, and it's you know it's a really it's an older crowd, and it's, you know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, but, you know, if it's a hit with them, and if I can piggyback that on getting gigs in those clubs, then yeah, I'm down, you know, for sure. It's just a matter of what life is all about what your expectations are, right? So expectations have to change a bit, you know, nowadays, I think.
Yeah, you're right in the respect that, like, certain things are coming back, but, I mean, we look at who is, I guess, like, you know, the generation du jour, right? And the youngsters that are coming up, you know, that I got nothing really bad to say about them, but I just think that they could do a little bit more to expand their musical tastes, you know? That's all.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, well, you know, people, you know, Disclosure have come out with a lot of cool tracks. You know, they've incorporated the old with the new. I mean, there are people who are making records that do that. You know, it's not that no one does it, but, you know, there's some good music coming out.
Oh yeah, I hear it. Who's did you talk to Quincy Jones about that young kid that he was working with?
No.
There's this young kid that's Quincy Jones. It's like he's pushing this dude, like, and the kid is just literally amazing. And
yeah,
but the only, oh man, I forget the guy's name, man. Anyway, the only thing is, it's like certain dudes like that, right? Like the guys, he's not a mimic, and that's the thing. Like, yeah. I see a lot of, I guess it's just because that YouTube stuff's out there where everybody can see how John Bonham played drums, or how Stevie Ray Vaughan played guitar, or how Luther Vandross sang and stuff, that I guess that all these different vocabularies become part of you earlier on. And it just seems like some of these young people are just so fucking talented, but they can't really focus it on a song or a style.
Well, they don't have true creativity. They're good at, they're good singers, but they're not great writers, or they're decent writers, but they don't, you know, it's finding stuff that's unique. But, you know, I'm definitely not one of those guys who go, oh, they don't do it like they used to. You know, it's just like, you know, it's, you could say that the, you know, the Rolling Stones weren't as good as Muddy Waters. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I
hear you. You know what I mean?
To me,
that doesn't even matter. It's like, they're making music not for us. They're making music for their kids their own age.
Yeah.
And kids their own age think they're great. So we could say, oh, it's not as good as it was when we were doing it.
But the
Stones, and maybe it's not, but it isn't really relevant. You know, to me, it's not relevant. I mean, it would be great when you hear someone who's amazing and he's a young, amazing act that's unique. I mean, you know, I like Childish Gambino. Those records, I think they're really good. Obviously, they're very derivative. Kendrick Lamar is super talented. You know, he's maybe a little bit more creative, but, you know, they're affected by what came before, just like you were and I was.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's just, you know, they're sampling things that, you know, were being made when we were making music too. So, you know, I hope someone samples my shit again, you know.
Well, I'm
all day. I mean, Khalid just did, what's his name? DJ Khaled? He just sampled one of my tracks. So that's good. That'll pay for, you know, a couple of weeks of private school.
Well, you know what, man? I mean, someone's making money because these guys can pay for sample clearances, you know?
Yeah.
He's a Miami guy, right? He's a local for you, right?
Yeah, he is, but I've never met. I mean, he sampled Perfect Beat about 10, 15 years ago. He had a huge hit with it. He slowed it down.
Yeah.
That was like full on, you know, we got like half of it.
Well, dude, man, I mean,
for the publishing catalog, you know, you still get something on it, you know?
Yeah, man, like, if you retain your publishing, man, you always retain your wealth, bro. Well, so, dude, when are you over here? When's that, when the music's coming out?
Yeah, I'm going to be there. I'm actually going to be in town on July 25th through August 3rd. And then August 5th, I'm playing at Razzmatazz in Barcelona.
All right, good spot, man.
Yeah, I love that place. You know, that's my boy Javier there. He's hooking me up. I'm actually DJing with Todd Terry, which should be fun.
Yeah, he's a dude, man. I love Todd.
Are you DJing much?
I'm doing Glastonbury this year. I mean, the thing is, I get a lot of people ask me to do like club gigs and shit like that. So I try to get out there because I want to keep my hand in it, make sure I can still
well, listen, a friend of mine, I'm doing something when I'm there. And when I told my friend, the guy who was like, kept beeping my phone. He said he'd love it if me and you did a gig together.
Oh, that'd be awesome. That'd be awesome, dude.
So let me I'll email you the date and see if you can do it.
All right, dude. I'm totally trying, man. That'd be awesome.
And it's in Brixton too, and it's a super cool club.
What's it called?
Have you been to the Dog Star?
No, I haven't, man. Nice spot.
Oh man, fuck! It's insane. Literally, he's been running this place for like 15 years, man. On the weekends, it's literally unreal. Like, it's just fully crazy. I mean, literally, you know, packed, amazing crowd, people dance. It's just mental. It's like a big old school pub, two floors. I mean, I did a gig with Flash there, which was amazing. I mean, we did a gig together. So I'll email you the date and see if you can make it, if you're around, you know.
That's awesome, man. I'd love to try, man. I definitely want to come check it out. I definitely want to do a gig with you, bro.
Yeah, well, trust me, that would be the one to do for sure. It's fun. It's a fun place to do. It would be cool.
All right, cool. Well, yo, dude, I'll tell you what, man. Let's try to catch up when you're over here, man. I appreciate you taking the time with me, bro.
Oh, no problem. No problem at all.
Well, I love you, Arthur, and I hope I send my love to your family. Your ladies, as it goes.
Love to the family. Love to your family, all right?
Back at you, my brother. Thanks, man.
All right, take care, man.
Peace off, man. So you heard the man. Check him out. He's over in London and Barcelona this summer. You should catch him on one of his badass DJ sets while you can. Next up, I'm talking to my man Chris Lent. This guy is the producer of, among many things, the National Geographic show Drugs, Inc. that just hit Netflix as well. Now, I've worked on that show with Chris, narrating the escapades of the illegal drug business in the world for over 5 years now, and it's great to see it go mainstream. So check it out, subscribe to the pod, and get the next episode direct to your device and the inside scoop on what it takes to make a TV show with some of the most dangerous criminals and gangsters in the world. And while you're at it, don't forget to rate, review in the iTunes Store or Acast or your favorite pod app. Pause reviews help us get more people in to do these things. So until next time, y'all stay classy. This is Huey, your boy.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.